I'm David Ignatius. I'm a columnist for the Washington Post, and I have the pleasure of acting as moderator today for our discussion of the Arab Spring and prospects for a nuclear weapons free zone in the Middle East. It's a topic of great interest and importance, and we have a very knowledgeable panel that I want to introduce and then turn to. Starting immediately on my left, Ambassador Dori Gold, former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, who is now president of the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Next, Egyptian Ambassador Mahmoud Karim, who is a board member of the Egyptian Council on Foreign Affairs, and who wrote an early book on this idea of a weapons-free zone in the Middle East that was published in the United States some years ago and did groundbreaking work on it. And finally, Shahram Chuban, who is a non-resident fellow of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace based in Switzerland, who wrote last year on Iranian attitudes towards this question of a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East former Iranian citizen knowledgeable about all aspects of their policy. Let me just introduce this subject by noting that the idea of a nuclear weapons-free, weapon of mass destruction-free zone in the Middle East has been a dream for many analysts, and I underline dream, since the 1970s. It seemed to make progress towards serious discussion in 2010, when the United States encouraged the idea that there would be a serious review of this issue and steps to get to this issue, to serious discussion and eventual implementation by the end of 2012. And as this audience I'm sure knows, that scheduled review with a deadline of the end of 2012 was deferred when the principal parties were unable to come to an agreement about the terms of reference. The United States said in November of 2012, last November, in announcing that this would be deferred, that current conditions in the Middle East made such discussion impractical. And certainly conditions have only gotten more unstable in the months since then. We now have on the agenda a scheduled meeting for further discussion of the idea that's supposed to take place in Geneva later in April. And one of the questions is whether that meeting will in fact go forward and how the principal parties feel about it. So with that introduction, I want to turn to the members of the panel. I've asked each of them, please, to limit their comments in this opening conversation to 5 to 7 minutes. Then we'll have a half hour or so of a discussion led by me, and then we'll turn to you in the audience and ask you for your questions of our panel on this important subject. So let me begin. Ambassador Dori Gold, I began with you, and so perhaps I'll start that way. We'll just go in that order in which we're sitting.
Well, thank you, David. First, a clarification before I get into substance. I'm here in a personal capacity. I don't represent the government of Israel or its foreign ministry. And with that said, it should also become clear that I don't approach this subject as someone who thinks that the time is ripe to go down this road. But I do think asking the question about the changes occurring in the Middle East and its impact on a weapons of mass destruction free zone is an appropriate question and worthy of analyzing in detail. David, you are quite right in pointing to the U.S. statement that actually was issued by Victoria Nuland, the spokeswoman of the U.S. Department of State, on November 23rd of last year. And she said that basically the meeting on the weapons of mass destruction free zone was being delayed for two principal reasons. One, the states in the region can't agree. And the basis of any conference or convening any forum on this subject had to be consensus. But actually, the second reason, which you also alluded to, is also very important to look at. And that is, she said that the present conditions in the Middle East were not such that moving forward on this subject made sense right now. Now, I don't know what exactly she meant by present conditions. So I'll give you my interpretation of why this point of present conditions is so important to focus on. You know, going back to when past Israeli prime ministers spoke about a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East, not a weapons of mass destruction free zone, a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. I was reading the other day the speech made by former Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir in 1988 in the General Assembly. And he was talking about the need, first of all, for a regional process, not a global process right now. But he also made the point that by having the states in the region negotiate a nuclear-free zone, that is, of course, after peace has been reached and full reconciliation, he said the very process of negotiating would help with the accommodation between the parties of the region. So it was seen as a vehicle, aside from the classic peace process, which is supposed to reach a point of maturation beforehand, it was a way of basically creating new attitudes of reconciliation between the parties. Now, when we look at what we call, for lack of a better term, the Arab Spring, we see a couple of features that have developed that raise serious questions of whether that could be achieved. First of all, when you have a proliferation of Islamist parties, some related to branches of the Muslim Brotherhood, some related to other organizations, there is no accommodationist element there. In the case of Egypt, Israel has excellent relations with the Egyptian army. But the highest levels in Israel do not have a relationship with the highest levels in Egypt. And in the meantime, Israelis who speak Arabic can go to the website, Ikhwan Web, and see what the supreme guide, the murshid of the Muslim Brotherhood, Muhammad Badi, states about Israel. And I'm not picking old quotes from 2010 that were on the front page of the New York Times about Mr. Morsi's attitudes. He speaks about jihad. He speaks about maintaining the state of conflict with Israel as a religious obligation. So how are you going to use the discussions of a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East or a weapons of mass destruction-free zone to lower the level of conflict when you're in a new ideologically charged environment? Second point. The state system in the Middle East right now is going through, for lack of a better word, chaos. Chaotic situation. States are breaking down. There are whole parts of Libya, Cyrenaica, where the central government in Tripoli barely has control. And we, of course, talk to the Egyptians about the problems in the Sinai Peninsula. But I foresee in the future in Syria there will be areas where whoever arises to power in Damascus will not be in effective control. So how can you come to state-to-state understandings when whole areas that the state is normally sovereign in could be outside the scope of any agreement you reach? And with that comes a third point, and with this I'll come to a conclusion, the rise of non-state actors. Now, two principal types of non-state actors that are worthy of discussion are, first of all, those who are loyal to Iran, for example, Hezbollah, which is basically a branch of the Iranian intelligence organizations. And it's worthy of mentioning in this context because Hezbollah is now receiving weaponry that in the past, states that supported terrorism didn't transfer. You're seeing state-of-the-art shore-to-ship missiles that were used in the 2006 Lebanon War against an Israeli ship. You're seeing rockets like the Zalzal and others, which are relatively in our region, longer-range rockets, which are now in the hands of Hezbollah. The weaponry going into the Gaza Strip, which goes to Hamas but not to Hezbollah. But nonetheless, the Hezbollah concern of ours is that if the barrier of weapons transfers in the past was relatively low, preventing anything beyond relatively low-level conventional weapons getting to terrorist organizations, that barrier is lifted and raises a question for us in the future about the transfer of weapons of mass destruction, particularly as they become free in Syria. The second case, of course, is Al-Qaeda. Now, you know, we're very aware of what al-Qaeda's been doing in our part of the Middle East. In 2004, al-Qaeda in Iraq, under the command of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, attempted to launch a chemical weapons attack against the GID headquarters in Amman. There were other hotels and other facilities that were targeted. But if chemical weapons were part of al-Qaeda's planned, modus operandi, then we're talking about non-state actors not signed onto any of these agreements that are going to seek the very weapons that they ban. So you're going to tie the hands of responsible governments while irresponsible entities are threatening our population centers. To conclude, I don't just want to paint a dark picture and leave it at that. I believe there is something that we can do that would be very important for how we proceed in the future. Years ago, I was in Amman, hosted by His Royal Highness Prince Hassan. And he invited us to the Hashemiyah Palace to discuss Middle East security issues. And Henry Kissinger was there. And he turns to me and he says, "What you need is a code of conduct for the Middle East." And the notion of the code of conduct, he explained subsequently to me, was that when I was starting the arms control effort on behalf of the United States with SALT I, I didn't want to be in a position that I would be limiting the growth of our strategic forces while the Soviet Union was moving around the third world, whether in Angola or in Central America, challenging the United States and undermining U.S. security. So he created general rules of engagement between the two superpowers, which was in parallel to the SALT I agreement. In the past, Israelis and our Arab counterparts have spoken about the need for a CSCE in the Middle East. The notion here is to build confidence. The notion here is to get beyond the reality that we're locked into. And if we actually undertake that, which, by the way, is part of our peace treaty with Jordan, I believe we can at least chart a course that would be much more productive. But to right now go into serious arms control agreements when the whole state system in the Middle East is breaking down, you know, it's no longer a question of whether Resolution 242 is going to be implemented, it's a question of whether Sykes-Picot is going to hold. And under these conditions, we have got to build confidence. We have to have a dialogue with our neighbors, and we have to build the kind of effort that was done by the West and the East back in 1975. I'll stop here.
So thank you to Ambassador Gold for a provocative, intellectually rich opening. Ambassador Karam.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Carnegie, for inviting me. I'm really very happy to be here, but also in a sense say that listening to Dorian and the arguments that he has presented, these are very consistent, valuable arguments from your point of view, depicting a certain security paradigm. And in all honesty, I'm someone who has been negotiating with Israelis, sitting and trying to do arms control and regional security acres, and make sense of this whole process. And the point is that all these arguments have been consistent and have always been on the table, but they also deflect the real issue on the table. The issue is a regional security paradigm that we are all trying to structure together. You cannot operate in the Middle East being part and parcel of the Middle East and remain away policies of insulation, whatever, and so on. No, Israel is part of the region. And the security threats that you so ably presented are also security threats faced by other regional states. When you speak of Sinai, I tell you, of course, we share the same common threat. So instead of making this a point of difference, we can make it a point of cooperation. And the fact remains is that Israel, in terms of differential power, Israel's differential power today is in a much better condition than it was before. What does this mean? It means that this is the time for serious decisions on your part. Because, as I said, the power pendulum is in your favor now. perhaps the armies in the Middle East are in a process of decay. We have seen this in Syria and Libya and so on. Other armies are very busy with building domestic peace and tranquility and so on. But what it tells us, that it is very important for you to take decisions at this very important. We are not talking to each other, Dori. There is no multilateral tracks. As much as we want CBMs, as you mentioned, there are no confidence-building measures taking place. Just take the issue of Sinai, for example. The liaison officer, which was established, office that was established after the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt, is a model of success. It has managed over so many years to bring Egyptian army officers and Israeli army officers under the patronage, or if you will, the assistance of others, MFOs and so on, to discuss violations and to quickly seek solutions for these violations. This can easily spill over into other areas. So, and then there is no interlocutor. Where is the United States? We all understand that it is very important for democratic transition in our part of the world. It is axiomatic to speak of democracy, of human rights, and social justice, and good governance, and so on. But there shall be no viable security system in the Middle East that would concentrate only on one component and neglect the other. This situation will, and it has been tried in other regions, in Europe and so on. So what you need is a viable security system that would assist in the process of confidence building between partners. We are partners of the same region, and it is very important to arrive at this stage of a viable cooperative security structure that we can implement and we can put our... Finally, the Helsinki process. I think it's a shame to see this process derailed.
The new Helsinki or the old Helsinki?
You mentioned Victoria Nuland's statement and so on, and Qaeda. Mind you, when you have a commitment that dates back to 1995, you were not part of this commitment. You were out. We were negotiating with the United States at the time, and it was the United States, the principal negotiator, that prepared the resolution, and then two other depositories came on board of that resolution, the Russian Federation and the United Kingdom, as depositories of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and as co-sponsors of that resolution. This is part of a package that made the extension of the NPT in 1995 possible. Without it, there would have been no Arab support. But when we were negotiating the resolution itself, there were three Arab countries who were not yet party of the Non-Proliferation Treaty: Djibouti, Oman, and United Arab Emirates. And we were told at the time, no name calling. So if you measure the terms of progress, what happened from 1995, you have the three Arab countries joining the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and universality, regional universality, is blocked by who? By Israel. So you need corollary measures. And therefore, when you have a decision by 2010 to hold a conference in 2012, and please, this is very important because there was a date specified in that proposal, then you expect a progress to happen. It's not going to happen and conclude in one day. What you want to do out of the new Helsinki process is a process in itself, is open a discussion on what we can do together in terms of elements of a nuclear weapon and weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East. Israel is part of the consensus. You joined the consensus in 1980 on a resolution in the General Assembly calling for the establishment of a nuclear weapon free zone in the Middle East. So when you don't have this kind of if you will, pressure to get into this kind of effort, then you will end up with other issues like going back to the IAEA with a political resolution no one likes on Israeli nuclear capabilities and so on. No, there is a lot of benefit from going into the Helsinki process. I personally believe that the process, that the conference itself will help even soften bring on board the Iranians, and it will be extremely important to have the Iranians on board. It will build confidence by having Israeli officials and Iranian officials and Arab officials sit together and try to make sense on terms of reference, on what do we mean, on the regional geographic delineation of the zone. Verifiable measures, you mentioned that in your paragraph, is important, but this can very well come at the end. We can agree on measures, but verification usually comes at the very end of the process of establishment of zone. So please let us not torpedo the whole process, because there is a great deal of benefit that may come out of it, particularly within the Helsinki process.
Ambassador Karim, before I turn to Dr. Chubin, I want to ask you one point of clarification, if I might. There has been a talk in the press in the last few weeks that Egypt may lead other members of the Arab League to boycott the meeting that is planned for later this month in Geneva to review the next steps in the Helsinki process. I know you're not a representative of the U.S., of the Egyptian government here, but could you give us your best information about what Egypt is likely to do?
David, it's not because Egypt wants to do that. Egypt so happens to be the present chairman of the Arab group, so they have certain responsibilities that they have to honor in terms of this group of high officials. But once again, there is a great deal of consternation in the Arab world on the official level and on the non-official level. On the official level, we have seen three resolutions come out of the Arab League, one in January, the other on the 13th of March, and the third only a few days ago in Doha. And the language of the resolution is very bitter. Why? Because actually the cancellation of the conference came at a very delicate stage, only a few weeks before the convening of the conference, and sabotaging a long process of negotiations and efforts and pre-negotiations phase by the parties concerned and the facilitator himself. So we must understand that is a great deal of bitterness that links to the package that I have referred to of the 1995 package. On the civil society, there's also a great deal of displeasure. We started in our own council an effort with two or three NGOs trying to make sense of this whole process. We are now 19 members of very reputable NGOs in the Arab world, and they are all in favor of boycotting the second, the third PROPCOM, boycotting the conference. And the most dreadful of all is Article 10, that it should come into consideration at one point. If this is going to be the course of action, if we work for years and then immediately before the conference, we end up with a situation such as this without even consultation with the Arab world, then we very well should invoke Article 10.
That sounds like a boycott at this point is, let's say there's considerable political pressure for one. We'll come back to this in our broader discussion, but I should turn to Dr. Chubin.
Thank you. My first comment would be to say that I'm not now, nor have I ever been, a spokesman for the Iranian government. So, like Doria, I'm not speaking for any government. What I will try and do is try and give you a sense of how I think the Iranians look at these issues. And I'll do it in two ways, though. First, talk a little bit about the Arab Spring, and secondly, a little bit about how Iran looks at arms control. And then in the discussion, talk about the specific proposal of the free zone. And I think we should recognize the professional deformation many of us have, which is to think that what is procedurally necessary is necessarily more likely. That is, something is happening at the end of April or whatever because of some PREPCOM review that then leads to a review, and therefore this issue becomes suddenly either more viable or more important or more topical. I think that against that, we see the Arab Spring and the dynamic elements in the society, some of which have accumulated over time. And this proposal is a very old proposal. It isn't necessarily going to be see the light of day because diplomats' convenience is ensured thereby. Now, the Arab Spring. First, the priority has clearly shifted to domestic issues of governance. Governments are weak, besieged, and societies are divided. Each case is particular. Dore mentioned Libya. There are other cases, Yemen, Egypt, Tunisia, Syria, Bahrain. They're all different. There's been a notable lack of reference to or emphasis on the Palestinian-Israeli issue. And in fact, references to the resistance front, insofar as they exist, have been references to resistance against local oppressors. There's a deepening sectarian polarization in the country, in the region, and I think this has all weakened Iran's attempts at extending its influence. Now, we're dealing with a long transition process, and it's uncertain. We've seen Islamist groups, some of whom are militant and assertive, and there may well be a temptation for governments to resort to populist tactics, and that may mean using foreign policy for domestic purposes, which may not be useful. There will be that temptation. And I think this will make preventing non-proliferation and even more denuclearization more important, but probably less possible. I should also mention that regional alignments are in flux, and pushing through agreements may be difficult also due to the government's incapacities or priorities. Now, let me say something briefly about Iran's attitude toward arms control in general, but with specific reference to the NPT, very briefly. First, I think Iran's attitude toward the international order is the first point. I won't go into that. The Iranians consider this a just unjust international order, and they see arms control basically as a trap. Using the old phrase that India used to use of disarming the unarmed. So arms control in the nuclear area in particular is unequal. It's unjust, inequitable, selective in application, and the NPT quintessentially is an unequal treaty. And Harold Müller had something to say about inequality yesterday. We live in an era where equality is considered the norm. Inequality, it's difficult to maintain that unequal norm in the current era. Iran also sees inspectors as spies, partly because information given to inspectors is often national intelligence, and also because of the precedents in Iraq, Nunavik, and elsewhere. And Iran sees itself as a victim of non-enforcement and selectivity. That is, non-enforcement, some countries who haven't joined the treaty, and selective enforcement against some countries who have. So Iran's attitude towards security generally is zero-sum. It's a strict constructionist in the sense that it takes a literalist, minimal reading of its obligations. And in regards to confidence building, it asks who in fact needs to be reassured. Iran sees opacity and ambiguity as force multipliers and rejects transparency. You may have heard an earlier panelist say something similar yesterday about China. I think that that's very much the case, that in the Iranian case, this ambiguity and uncertainty magnifies, they believe it magnifies their power. So to think of confidence building in terms of transparency and so on is perhaps not realistic in the Iranian sense. And predictability is also not an Iranian value or an objective. Now, there are a few things that Iran rejects, doesn't want to happen. One is, it doesn't want to be singled out. Secondly, it doesn't want to assume new responsibilities or obligations. You could argue they probably wouldn't have joined the NPT if they hadn't inherited it. Secondly, they don't want to be excluded from fora. So by and large, they will turn up to conferences if they're the only one who won't. And within conferences, they prefer not to be isolated, which means that they don't want to be the only obstacle two. Now, last week we saw with North Korea and Syria on the conventional arms that they were willing more or less to be isolated in very unattractive company. But by and large, the Iranians prefer to try and let other people do their battles for them and not to be the only obstacle. And they will, of course, try and use any fora they can to single out Israel for castigation rather than talk about their own obligations or their compliance. I'll leave it at that for the moment, and then we can come back to the specific.
Let me turn first to Ambassador Gold, but it's a question that I'd be interested in all of the panelists' responses, if they have them. I think it's fair to say that in the United States, among strategists, there's been something of a revolution in the way people think about the utility of nuclear weapons. Obviously, a generation ago, they were seen as a crucial element in American security, and the possession of them, the plan for conceivable strategy for their use was central. Today, I think many Americans many American strategists would say nuclear weapons pose a danger to the United States through proliferation and the availability of fissile materials to terrorists and perhaps their use by rogue states such as North Korea, but they pose very little benefit. We're not in a world anymore like the Cold War where massive nuclear arsenals and the threat they pose give you much additional security. So, Ambassador Gold, I want to put that to you specifically thinking about Israel. Wouldn't it be fair to say, much as we do in the U.S., that nuclear weapons, hypothetically, don't give Israel much additional security, but as they proliferate, pose a very substantial threat, and that for that reason, Israel, more than any country, would have a reason to be interested in this process rather than obstruct it?
Well, Israel helped facilitate the process at the very beginning. It supported the NPT. It didn't sign it. But going back to 1968, and Israel, of course, took part in these discussions with its neighbors, like the Acres process after the Moscow meeting post-Madrid in the 1990s. But you got to get some perspective on this situation. You know, Israel does not have a posture of overt nuclear deterrence. It has a posture of nuclear ambiguity. It will not be the first country to introduce nuclear weapons into the Middle East. That posture, you might ask whether that has any utility today. And I think it certainly does. And it's tied to the fact that of all the countries in the world today, Israel is the only state whose very existence is threatened by not just one of our neighbors, but particularly by one of our neighbors. Now, I know in the United States there was a big debate when President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad made the statement, Israel must be wiped off the map. And people said, well, the New York Times mistranslated him. Well, we actually, in my think tank, hired Farsi speakers to go over everything he said, everything Khomeini said, everything the heads of the Revolutionary Guards have said, and it's clear as day. They call for the destruction of Israel. So that puts us in a very different position than the strategists who might talk about, well, does nuclear deterrence work in Europe when the Soviet Union no longer exists and you don't have to defend NATO from the Warsaw Pact? I think we have a unique situation, and that unique situation generates our positions on these issues. But to go back to what I was also saying earlier, the Middle East is going into a period of chaos. And arms control assumes that there is some kind of basic international order in place. So rather than just say it's hopeless, leave us alone, let's just go back and everybody go to his own country, I'm suggesting that we create a path of confidence building that gets us through the current phase and brings us into some kind of dialogue which allows us to move forward with regional security in the future.
What would that path of confidence building look like?
Well, if we're looking at, as I said before, old Helsinki, not new Helsinki, the CSCE, for example, that was built around certain baskets of issues that were relevant for the dialogue between East and West at the time, such as economic cooperation at the time, or CBMs that were based on advanced notification of military exercises. In our case, in the Middle East, the CBMs would have to be different. One of the most important fundamentals that's necessary is a clear commitment by the parties in the Middle East to not give any support for international terrorist organizations. That's in binding UN resolutions. When the Muslim Brotherhood came to power in Sudan in the 1990s, well, guess who was setting up training camps there? Osama bin Laden, Hamas, and there are others. We have to make sure that there's a regional consensus that we're not going to permit either financing or setting up these types of organizations on a signatory's territory. That would be one way of taking this process that existed in Europe and applying it to the Middle East. But there could be other baskets of issues that are specifically relevant for Middle Eastern security.
Ambassador Karam, what about that idea of saying to make this idea even remotely plausible to Israel, but to all parties, you need things like a commitment that nuclear weapons will not be used for terrorism, indeed that terrorism will not be used in the region. And let's take the specific case of Syria, because we're all watching it. We see central government disintegrating in Syria. We expect a transition in which Syria's weapons of mass destruction may be up for grabs. Is there a way that you think the Arab League or Egypt, as the leading power, arguably, in the Arab League, could structure some process of transition so that in this period of instability, there was greater assurance, not just for Israel, but for Egypt, for all the parties in the region, that proliferation of weapons of mass destruction wouldn't get worse and worse as the Arab Spring rolls on?
Absolutely. There's no disagreement there. Remember, the very first initiative on a nuclear weapon-free zone in 1974 was complemented by another initiative in 1990 by adding two other components. And these two other components, biological and chemical weapons, were introduced by the Egyptian delegation in a summit in Baghdad at the time. And our biggest enemy in that conference were the Iraqis themselves. So the point is that we were trying to present to the Arab world that it is extremely important to prohibit and to seek commitments by all the parties concerned and build towards a viable verification mechanism. But you will not establish a viable security, cooperative security structure in the Middle East by putting a priori conditions and saying we will begin with confidence-building measures and we will not discuss the other issues. And incidentally, this is how ACRES fell apart. Because at the time, we were saying let us discuss all the matters because they are all important. Conventional weapons are important. Confidence-building measures are important. Routine visits to sites are important, but so are nuclear weapons. If you speak of what Dori mentioned, nuclear ambiguity, I think this policy was not really helpful toward the security of the Middle East. First of all, deterrence against whom? Israeli nuclear arsenal against whom? And are you going to use nuclear weapons in a conventional war? This will not happen. Are you going to nuclear weapons in this geographic location of the Middle East, not knowing what direction the wind may take and so on? So actually, the idea itself is a threat to Israeli national security in the first place because of the geographic location and delineation of our zone. And I am very sorry to say that it has led to an incentive for other nations to seek parity by conventional means, poor man's nuclear weapons, for example. We have seen this in the chemical program of Libya, of Iraq, of Syria, of Iran, and so on. There's always the incentive that because of this nuclear ambiguity, because of the lack of commitment on the part of Israel in this regard, there will always be seeking another alternative. But there are also other matters that are extremely important in my point of view, which is the moon. Dimona is aging. All of us, including our Israeli friends, would feel more secure if Dimona was placed under IAEA safeguards. So this could be a very well first step. We can all be reassured that Dimona may not be aging and that the Israelis can do a better job than inspectors from the IAEA. But what about the waste? What about the containers? What about the seismic activities? And what about the water resources in case an accident of this sort was to happen in the Negev Desert and the negative impact of that on subterranean water resources? One last point I want to make is that there, with Israel's nuclear capability, and particularly within the peaceful uses, Article 4 of the NPT in this regard, many positive things can come out, including cooperation in desalination. Water is a very expensive commodity in the Middle East, including the eradication of the Mediterranean fly. There are no boundaries or borders between Jordan, Egypt, Cyprus, and so on. What contaminates our plantations can very easily, and it does, contaminate Israeli energy security and so on. So the point I'm trying to, the health sector, physical protection of material, there are so many ideas that we can work out together and possibly put the Israeli peaceful nuclear program in a better context.
Ambassador Gold, I'd be interested in your specific response to that. You can argue, as Ambassador Karim just did, that Israel's policy of nuclear ambiguity has not bought it much security. Iran doesn't seem to be deterred in the slightest by it. And I also thought Ambassador Karim made a very interesting point about aging facilities at Dimona that have been widely written about. Why wouldn't it be in everyone's interest, including Israel's, for that to be part of an NPT, IAEA-inspected regime?
Well, again, Israel's taken a position on these issues in terms of its regional proposals. But I have a question in your underlying assumptions, and I'd also be interested in our Iranian partner giving us an answer to this. You assume that Iran's drive to get nuclear weapons is because of their concerns with what Israel might have or might not have. It seems to me, as somebody who studied this, that Iran is seeking to cross the nuclear threshold, perhaps in the next year or so, specifically because it's a hegemonic power that's asserting itself all over the Middle East after the collapse of Iraq. And the acquisition of nuclear military capability is part of Iran's own ambitions, but it is not a function of what Israel might have, doesn't have, talks about, doesn't talk about. And to assert that there's a connection there, I think is a fundamental misreading of what's in the mind of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei.
Well, Dr. Truman, that's quite a task to take on, put yourself in the mind of the Supreme Leader, but do speak about how these issues are perceived in Tehran.
Well, how they're perceived in Tehran from what is what I think analytically are quite different things probably. I think they're seen in Iran, at least in this respect, that Israel singling out of Iraq and Iran's missile capabilities from 1990 onwards, and it's perfectly understandable given Saddam Hussein and the War of the Cities that occurred in the war, and the continuous threats of Israel to take out Iranian facilities stimulated an Iranian, this is how the Iranians see it, stimulated an Iranian reaction to arm Hezbollah to create a short-term deterrent against such an attack while they built up their missile range capabilities. Now, the question of whether or not Israel's nuclear weapons are the reason why Iran is developing them. I agree with Dori. I think that I don't know what the perception in Iran is. I know what the propagandist explanation is. But I think generally it has nothing to do with it, except insofar as Israel is seen as pretending to have a veto over what Iran can do. I mean, I think that point is nationalist in the sense that in Iran, the sense that the Israelis can sit there with their nuclear monopoly in an ambiguous circumstance and start deciding who is entitled in the region to get what. That sense is I think, very annoying to the Iranians. But otherwise, I don't think the Israeli strategic weapon that's latent is the driving force for the Iranian program.
And let me ask you to focus a little bit more specifically on Iranian attitudes toward the Helsinki review process, especially in the context that we've been discussing.
Well,
is it possible that they would see it as being necessary, given their existing positions, to join in a process if it went forward? And if so, would there be a way to structure that process so that it yielded benefits in terms of the larger issues that are being discussed in the P5 plus one negotiations, the most recent session just concluded in Almaty, sadly without much evident progress? So you could argue, here's another track that the Iranians have to go down because they're NPT signatories. What about that?
Absent a change of perspective from the regime, I think the way they would look at Helsinki is they'd like to go. I mean, they would go because they don't want to be on the menu by not going. They don't see it as an opportunity strategically to change their relationships in the region. They would look at it much more as a tactical opportunity. In other words, they might seek this as a way of saying to the P5, look, we're talking. And then create, the preconditions so that the talks wouldn't go anywhere. If they decide that the pressure from sanctions and their relative regional isolation requires them to adapt, they will adapt tactically. And they'll say, as I say, no more sanctions, please. Look, we're talking to the people in the region. So now, the question I would pose is a prior one, which is, would Iran be better off with this thing we're talking about, this Helsinki process leading eventually to a WMD-free zone? And then I ask myself, well, what is being banned? What is being banned? It's not just the nuclear. It's also the missiles. What do the Iranians want these missiles and this certain ambiguity about WMD for? Well, partly it's to balance others' nuclear weapons, and not necessarily just Israel's, others. Secondly, it's to balance advanced conventional weapons in Israel and the GCC, as the Iranians see it. And thirdly, it's a sort of regime guarantee to the way North Koreans play it, which is, we've got something under our belt here. Do we really want to give it up because we don't know what might happen in the future? And then if you look at the scope of any project, would it include Pakistan? Nobody's talked about that. The Iranians always have an out to say, look, our neighbor here is, we have sectarian issues with Pakistan, not nuclear weapons issues, but they are a nuclear weapons state. And then, of course, what about Turkey and NATO? And then what about the role of the extra-regional powers, the United States? Is it going to continue to be a guarantor and arms suppliers to the GCC? Is it going to be the enforcer of any state that contravenes it? And that the net result, I don't see the Iran, and then not to mention the question of sequencing and asking the Israelis to disarm before they come to the table and so on. I don't see it very easy to structure it so the Iranians would get something, given these linkages that I've mentioned, so that at the end of the day they'd be out better off than they were before they went in, unless they have a change of view as to how to deal with the region, and not see the U.S. as likely to create regime change, not see get access to better conventional weapons, not see themselves as besieged, and so on.
Those are helpful comments, and I want to continue in that vein by asking Ambassador Gold and others, if we imagine a regime in which Iran is effectively checked from obtaining, developing and obtaining nuclear weapons, and other states similarly don't move in that direction. We need to think about verification procedures that would be powerful enough that they would reassure not simply Israel, but Saudi Arabia, all of the other neighbors of Iran. And we also need to think about an IAEA that was even stronger and more credible than it is today. And so I'd like to ask to help us think, what would this world look like? Just to speak for a few moments, perhaps each of you, about what kind of verification regime would be required to establish confidence that this was for real. It wasn't an arms control dream, it was for real.
Well, again, I have to create some perspective here. I mean, we're sitting here in Washington. A IAEA signatory named North Korea has jettisoned its inspectors. It has conducted 3 nuclear tests, and it's threatened the United States. So it'd be really hard to come up with suggestions in this environment of how we can create an arms control regime for Iran that not just Israel can trust, the states of the region can trust. As I said before, maybe people like to think, well, Iran's doing this because somebody wasn't nice to Iran in 1953. Iran is doing this because it sees itself as the dominant power in the region, and it has expansive goals. I mean, just one other, General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force, of the Revolutionary Guards, speaks about Iraq, Lebanon, and Gaza as being under his control. That's the world you're dealing with, and those are the commanders who you're going to give nuclear weapons to if you don't stop the Iranian program. Now, of course, they talk about destroying us, but they view the Arab states as beneath them, as areas which are provinces of their own country, Bahrain being the 14th province of Iran, and now Syria is the 35th province of Iran. So I see this in a totally different context, and I'm not sure you can start doing academic models of verification when you're dealing with such an aggressive country that the world is failing to stop.
So I'll take the answer to the question I put as, unless the IAEA is a demonstrated force in restraining and denuclearizing North Korea, why should we take it seriously in our region? Yes?
Unless you want to write a show for the Sci-Fi Channel.
So, Ambassador Karam, I do want to, I think this question of verification about the what it would look like to have a regime that would be credible, I'd be grateful if you'd speak to that question.
Sure. First, we, in terms of history, we really must understand that the region has been living from 1962 until today under the policy of nuclear ambiguity. So this is not something new to the region. And yes, in my own humble view, I think there is a very strong causal relationship between that policy and other policies that that had happened. And I mentioned the case of Libya and so on. That is the first point. The second point is, insofar as Iran itself is concerned, why consider the differences between Iran and the IAEA as a threat to Israel alone? Look at policies of GCC countries in the same. They are extremely worried about that nuclear program as well. Kuwait is only a few miles away from their nuclear reactor, and what this may entail, which shall be at the expense of regional security, is reaching out for nuclear umbrellas, reaching out for missile protection, allowing facilities, and we have seen this in the case of Kuwait and NATO only a few weeks ago, signing an agreement with NATO and so on. So, invitation of extra-regional protection on GCC countries on this account. The point is that, yes, there may be a threat, and the threat is shared by us all. It is not only an Israeli threat, it is a threat for the whole region. On the verification regime, that's a very good question for the conference in Helsinki. It should be part and parcel of it. This regime should be very rigorous. It should rely on the technical capabilities and the safeguard capabilities of the IAEA. It should be gradual. I don't represent my government anymore, so I can speak. It should not jump to dreams that cannot be realized immediately. It should start incrementally, step by step. It should look and consider the issue of stockpiles, activities, and it should also consider the issue of mutual visits in order to increase regional confidence in the regime.
Let me throw out one more idea, which is that in this period of great instability and transition that we're calling the Arab Spring, what if the Arab League said that one condition of membership of the Arab League is that Arab League member governments, and we now have Muaz al-Khatib, the leader of the Syrian opposition, seated as the Arab League representative of Syria, a condition for him and the government, future government he would represent, would be non-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Would something like that be an idea worth exploring through the Arab League?
Could I just remind you very briefly of an endeavor that was conducted in the headquarters of the Arab League, a committee that worked for 13 long years. I presided that committee for 7. And we ended up with a draft treaty on the establishment of a zone free of weapons of mass destruction. And incidentally, when we started negotiating, this was times before Israel had peace with Jordan and so on. And the only peace Israel had at the time was with Egypt. And when we spoke with the Libyans at the time, with the Iraqis at the time, I'm speaking of 93, 94, the geographic declination had Israel as part and parcel of the region itself. I have argued to Arab League officials many times that it is about time to release this very important document and perhaps circulate it in the second or third PrepCom, because it is very easy to say no and so on and so forth. Incidentally, I don't think there will be any boycotting of the second PrepCom. This is why I wanted to come in earlier. I think there will be very fiery statements on the part of some of the Arab delegations, a very strong statement by the representative of the Arab states in Geneva, unfortunately going back to that resolution in Vienna and so on and so forth. But once again, I think it is important to release that document, and it actually answers a great deal of the verification model that you have referred to.
Can I just say something on verification? I think that it's obviously putting the cart before the horse, clearly. If I were an Iranian representative, I'd be saying that, look, we have inspections all the time. When did Israel have inspections? And clearly, at the end of the day, if you're going to have reciprocal on-site inspections, you can imagine what sort of the two countries, you can imagine what sort of political prerequisites there are before we get there. So I don't see this as a confidence-building measure so much as the product of the process, not the sort of early stages of the process.
Just a final question to you, and then I'm going to turn to the audience for your questions. Dr. Chubin, do you, as you read the Iranian press and talk to your sources, do you see any indication that there are strategic analysts in Iran who understand that as Iran moves toward the ability to make nuclear weapons, it is opening a bottle and virtually guaranteeing that Saudi Arabia will become a nuclear weapons state, that Egypt will become a nuclear weapons state. In other words, that its security in the future that it's entering will be radically less than it is today. Did you pick up any sign that people get that?
I know that some of the more senior people, including Mousavian, who's a former senior person, but also Rouhani, a former National Security Council secretary, and others have mentioned time and again that one of the reasons we don't want nuclear weapons is because we will alienate our immediate neighbors, which is not our intention, and we may end up worse off than we were beforehand. Now, you can argue that that's a debating, a propagandistic point, or you could argue it's a serious, serious point. I don't share this town's, I may as well make a career-ending intervention. I don't share this, and because of what may happen in the headlines next week, I don't share this town's emphasis on Iran getting nuclear weapons. I think Iran wants to go to the threshold, and we can define what the threshold is variously, and to dance around that threshold in a sustainable stalemate in which it doesn't get attacked, but it maintains its ability to enrich. I don't think the value or the utility of nuclear weapons has been really thought through, nor their configuration, nor the doctrine, and so on and so forth. I think that it's much more an incremental thing, and that it's now almost a point of pride that you do not give up on what you've done so far. You may give up parts of it, but you're not going to give up the sunk cost that our friends have talked about in their paper this morning. They presented this morning. That's a huge cost. So I don't share the idea that, you know, they're going to dash across the threshold. It's going to be much, much more long-term crisis, if you like, of trying to restrain them on the threshold or keeping them at the threshold or keeping them as far away from the threshold as possible.
So I'm going to turn now to the audience, and I'm going to go Mike to Mike. So please do line up. And I'd ask you, please, identify yourself, identify the person to whom you want to put the question, and please keep it short. Yes, sir.
I'm Vladimir Orlov, Beer Center in Moscow. Actually, I think that the fact that we didn't have conference in Helsinki in December is definitely a very sad thing, and it's not only a sad thing, it's a huge mistake. I do believe that U.S. administration did not invest, though it could, as much as it should have in bringing those parties who were hesitant to come to that conference. I'm afraid that not only at this PrepCom, but also later we would get very unfortunate fruits and results of that not very wise decision. In October last year, we had a gathering in Moscow where Israeli officials on the zone, Israeli officials were present, Iranian officials were present. There were meetings on the sidelines between Arab League representatives and Israelis. So thing was workable and doable, at least as a starting point. But a question goes to all the panelists and specifically to Ambassador Karim, not on this unfortunate development, but on a potentially constructive development. You mentioned, Ambassador, the issue of Dimona and the importance of looking at it. But we also all realize that with nuclear weapons in mind, or with nuclear energy and technology in mind, certain Arab countries or countries of the region not only have their nuclear installations like facilities like Iran, but also will go that way, as United Emirates certainly do, and Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and others may do, depending on financial and other circumstances. Is there a chance, before we come practically to the zone idea, that countries of the region, both Arab and non-Arab, I have, of course, Iran here first in mind, switch to lack of confidence, suspicions, to cooperation, both on nuclear energy development issues and more specifically on nuclear safety and security-related issues and dialogue? Thank you.
Ambassador Karim, do you want to take a shot at that?
Yes, thank you. I think that's a very good two-pronged question. My response would be that, yes, there have been a very serious mistake in the delay itself. And I explained that earlier. But there has been another mistake in the post-delay area, because I personally expected that when the delay happened, there should have been a great deal of contacts, particularly between Washington and the League of Arab States and key Arab countries in this regard, to explain that the Helsinki process is not dead and to assure that commitments will be upheld, and the explicit terms of reference of the 2010 process in itself is still alive and well, and we can designate a particular date. In fact, as we speak, everyone will be listening to the U.S. statement in the upcoming PrepCom, waiting for, you know, the magic sentence, a particular date, reviving hopes that the United States has set a new date for that conference. But also, with the same vein, there are particular proposals that have been on the table from January until today, including by the facilitator on something more informal, and by the Arab League, which does not see eye to eye with the facilitator. I personally feel that the differences between both are not huge. And once again, the interlocutor can play a very important role in bridging the gap between these two proposals and put things back on track. Now, is there a chance that countries of the Middle East should switch to peaceful uses of? I think in terms of regional security, it is important to put incentives of regional cooperation. And I cited some of them, the Mediterranean fruit fly, for example, which is responsible for a great deal of crop lost in Israel. And once this fly comes from Egypt or Jordan, there are no boundaries for something like that. Incidentally, the United States has dealt with this problem with Mexico, and it turned out to be an excellent cooperative program in this field. I hope that by bringing these viable alternatives, by thinking positively, by throwing in some positive ideas, that we can change positions in our part of the world, instead of the old dogma that we all hate and we all want to evade an end in this coming era. Let us think positively and see what we can do together.
Unless there are other responses.
Just one thing.
Yes.
The Gulf states, particularly Kuwait and others, have registered concern about safety in the Iranian reactor. And
Bushehr.
Yes, in Bushehr. And there's been, I think Iran feels to some extent isolated vis-a-vis the GCC. So it seems to me that this type of initiative might be a way for Iran to talk with its neighbors, and more importantly, to get the neighbors, maybe with input from some outside powers, to get the Iranians to look more seriously at the problems of safety and security of their reactor, and if they have a future program, of their future program. So it's a functional cooperation thing that might serve both sides' purposes, I think. So it's good. I like the idea, Vladimir.
Thank you. That's a useful colloquy. Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm Ahmad Saeed from Pakistan, and currently I'm a visiting fellow at James Martin Center for Non-Proliferation Studies, CNS, Monterey, California. My question is to Mr. Tor Gold. Sir, as you said that the nuclear weapon-free zone or disarmament by the Israelis, you know, it doesn't matter because of your security situations. But if you look at in the perspective of the Arab Spring, where the kingdomships and the dictatorships in the Middle East are being replaced by more strong kind of democratic governments, don't you think that like in the morning, our South Korean the ambassador, he also said that might be they look for a nuclear option, not to win the war against North Korea, but to prevent the war. So if you have more democratic kind of governments in the Middle East, not the kingdomship, which are listening to the Western pleas not to go for the nuclear, and they have their own strength in the system. So don't you think they can also opt for the, as per the Article 10 of the NPT, to leave NPT and develop the nuclear weapons for the security, not to win the war, but to prevent the war? In that case, how many nuclear reactors you'd be able to destroy, like it was done in Syria or the Iraq? If you do so, it will be another anarchy in the Middle East, in which the world powers will come in and join, and it will be all anarchy all around. So why don't you move a bit ahead towards the nuclear weapon free zone? My comment with regard to the Mr. Sharam's Cuban's statement that Pakistan's disarmament, when you talk about the Israeli part of it or the Iranian, if they do it, so why don't you talk about the Pakistan also? I do understand the Pakistan and Israeli security concerns are the same, that existential kind of threat we both face. But then the Israeli situation and the Pakistani situation is different. You are in the Middle East, and we are sitting right eyeball to eyeball with the Indian side, and the history between India and Pakistan hostilities you know better. So if Israel moves towards a peace process and leave the Syrian Golan Heights and the forms of the Lebanon, so maybe you leave no leverage for the Hezbollah, or for that matter, other militant parties to attack your population, and you'll be living in more peace and security.
Ambassador.
My second part, sir.
Let's get an answer to that, and we have other questions. I want to leave time for them, if that's all right. Ambassador.
Well, what we have is a fundamental disagreement over the situation on the ground, because when you use the language of spreading democracy, it sounds like, Thomas Jefferson Institute in Tripoli or something. And that we are not in those circumstances now. We are in a situation of state breakdown. Much of our negotiations in the past were based on the acceptance of the Westphalia system in the Middle East. And it's not clear that that's going to be there. And so you don't want to try and create a negotiating framework that is so divorced from reality that you lose credibility with your own public. And that's part of the problem we have right now. So, I think, yes, we need more interaction with our neighbors. Yes, I think we need more cooperation in all the fields like medical and others that have been mentioned. I think there's a lot more we can do in energy cooperation, particularly now on the Israeli side, that we have had massive maritime gas discoveries in the Mediterranean, and that we have some neighbors that are thirsty for energy, believe it or not. And we should look into these things. But to talk about nuclear free zones when the whole state system is on the verge of breaking down in the Middle East would just make us sound like we're, smoking something.
I would just note as a moderator's point of information that to the surprise of some analysts, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, which it was thought would lead to greater nuclear instability, proliferation, dissemination of material, in fact, did not lead to that. That the dissolution of that large nation, and the same could be said of Yugoslavia, but not nuclear terms, didn't lead to the outcome that you're describing. Just a point. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Bill Pott. I'm Bernd Kubik from PRIF in Frankfurt. I'm co-editing a series of policy briefs that hopefully helps the facilitator to not just to initiate but also to make a successful Helsinki conference. You can find this outside at the European desk. I have two comments and a question. The comment is on Iran. We have experienced at the last session of the EU Consortium on Non-Proliferation in Brussels on November 6th that the Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Mr. Sotanyi, elegantly orchestrated a yes of his government to the Helsinki process, or at least conference, period. I think Iran currently is not the problem. The problem is right now between Israel and the Arab states, and I would like to say much more right now on the side of the Arab states than on Israel. I think it would be great that we have a reset policy on the Arab side, and that means go to Helsinki as the mandate that you, as Egyptian, have negotiated requires. And that means to talk about in a way of freely arrived at. And I think to put conditions on the pre-Helsinki talks right now is the wrong thing to do. My question to you is, if I listen to the three of you,
Egyptian, thank you,
and especially to the two ambassadors, I get the impression the two of you could sit together and outline a nice and viable agenda for Helsinki. First of all, you agree on the importance of confidence-building measures. Agreements could occur 20 years, 30 years. But right now, it's confidence building. And the second thing is, where you, I think, agree on the agenda, could be that you have enemies or threats. And I think on the state level, you can coalesce Israel, Arab states towards Iran. And on the sub-state level, I think all of you, including Iran, could coalesce on defining the threat concerning Al-Qaeda and others. My fear is, or my impression is, it's your mutual fear that you cannot overcome that prevents you from going to Helsinki. If this analysis is right, our answer to it in the policy brief that you can find itself is, go there to Helsinki with a fantastic experienced facilitator, Mr. Lajava. Abide to the rule of freely arrived at, and just sit there and express your concerns in terms of security and on all levels. And I think this could be a starting point for a confidence-building pressure. Again, both of you said such a conference, and I end with this, could be a confidence-building measure by itself. So why not drafting a Washington WDC agenda and move the process for Helsinki ahead? Thank you.
Ambassador Gold, what about it? You're almost to Helsinki. Have you booked your ticket?
Well, I just want to remind everyone, the original idea of holding this conference last year at the end of 2012 was formulated in 2010. 2010 was before the events in the Middle East occurred. So that's why I'm suggesting we have to go to a completely different format from my perspective. And that format should be something which allows the parties in the region to identify what are the emerging threats that they both face and to find ways of working together to deal with them. But to speak about robust systems of monitoring and verification and when we're facing WMD spreading in Syria, when we're facing non-state actors who are not subjects of international law and therefore can't be bound to any of these agreements, whatever you put together, I think it requires us a little bit going back to the drawing board, but coming up with something that addresses reality as it's appearing and not something that looks good in a seminar that we could do in Europe.
Ambassador Karim, the questioner was sharply focused in saying Egypt should drop its objections and preconditions and get to Helsinki. What about it?
I'm not really sure whether these objections, I guess he meant objections to attending the second, third prep.
I understood the question to mean the possibility of boycott of this PrepCon. Yes.
Yes, this is part and parcel of phraseology of three Arab resolutions. I'm not really sure that Egypt was behind that. I'm not an official anymore, but reading the resolutions themselves. We are speaking of a resolution that dates back to January, another one on the 13th of March, and a third one that was just issued in... And the three resolutions speak of, quote-unquote, breach of obligations. Breach of obligation. This is the exact language the Arabs put in that resolution. Now, if you ask me personally, my very honest opinion is that I don't think that that we should boycott, that the difference can be made by going to the conference and by stating your position and by being proactive, but... I'm only a private citizen, and this is my view. My prediction, I said earlier, and I think the fact is that the Arab countries will go, expect very fiery statements in the second PrepCom. Hanging over our heads will be, shall we or shall we not go to the third preparatory, final preparatory committee, and finally, shall we attend the conference in itself or not? And here, I think it is very important for the Europeans, for the United States, to play a very important role in bridging the gap and to honor the term of reference of 2010. The date is very important.
Sir.
Howard Moreland, a private citizen. As I understand, all the nuclear weapons in the Middle East belong to two nations, the United States and Israel. U.S. has weapons in eastern Turkey. And Israel is the only Middle Eastern nation that has its own arsenal. So those are the two obstacles to creating overnight a nuclear weapon-free Middle East. My question is, nuclear weapons are useful only if they have targets. U.S. can hit any target anywhere. We don't need weapons in Turkey. But what nuclear targets would Israel be giving up if it lost its nukes and joined the NPT? In other words, what targets would Israel no longer be able to destroy if it only had conventional weapons?
Ambassador Gold, do you want to answer that question?
Well, we're here speaking about the diplomatic side. We're not here writing Tom Clancy novels. And so... you know, I think we should really focus on the diplomatic side of what all of this means. And as I said before, Israel is the only country in the entire, not just the Middle East, but in the world, which is now, whose very existence is being threatened. Now, that's pretty clear from the Iranian statements. But you know something? If you go into the Muslim Brotherhood websites, you find language which isn't far different. And therefore, the nature of the question really should be, how do we assure the stability of the Middle East when members of the Middle Eastern community are threatening the very existence of one member of that community? And when you come up with ideas for diplomatic initiatives, they have to address that fundamental question. I know here it's very hard to imagine because you're not used to the idea of somebody getting up in the morning and saying the United States should be wiped off the planet. But that's what's going on in my region. And therefore, Israel will do what's necessary to assure stability and assure that that's not going to be its fate.
So because we have only 5 minutes left, what I'm going to do is ask for the four questions and then ask for final comments from the panel. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Bill Potter, also from the Monterey Institute. I want to press Ambassador Gold a little bit. The focus of this panel was on the Arab Spring in the Middle East WMD-free zone. But in fact, the day after the review conference in 2010, in May 2010, well before the Arab Spring, Israel also made it very clear that they had no interest in participating in the Helsinki conference, though we didn't know it was going to be in Helsinki at that point in time. And yet the following year, Israel was prepared to participate in a related but different forum at the IAEA, also addressing a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. And in fact, about a month ago, when the Finnish facilitator proposed multilateral consultations in Geneva, Israel was prepared or signaled that it was prepared to participate, although interestingly, at that point in time, Egypt said it wouldn't participate. I'm trying to see some consistency here in the Israeli position. No in 2010, yes in Vienna, a positive signal in terms of consultations, in Geneva, and yet a reluctance to commit to Helsinki. What do you see as necessary to change in terms of an Israeli commitment to actually attend a meeting in the not too distant future in Helsinki without setting a firm date?
So let's collect all the questions, then turn to the panel. Yes, sir.
Dan Horner from Arms Control Today. I'd like to ask each of the panelists, what cost do you think each of the countries sees in not attending the WMD conference? If each of you could address that for your own country, your country of expertise, what costs are there either domestically or internationally? Dr. Chubin touched on this a little bit, but if the other panelists could talk about that. Thanks.
Yes, sir.
WPS Sidhu, Center on International Cooperation, New York University. There's an interesting parallel in South Asia on a nuclear weapon-free zone as well. In 1974, when India conducted a test, there was a proposal put forward for a nuclear weapon-free zone in the region. That carried on until 1998, when both India and Pakistan conducted nuclear tests, and that sort of resolution dropped off the face of the planet. The key question there is that while this was going on, India really had two options. One was to give up its nuclear weapons and accept a nuclear weapon-free zone in the region. Second was, very reluctantly, to accept the presence of another nuclear weapon state in its vicinity. In that context, and looking at the parallel with the Middle East, Ambassador Gold, Israel has a tremendous monopoly for the last 50 years or so, but it seems to me that it's now at a crossroads where it probably needs to decide whether it wants a nuclear weapon-free zone in the region or it needs to move into an area of deterrence. And related to that, you talked about the CSCE process in Helsinki, and absolutely I agree that that's something worth considering. But it's also worth considering that the CSCE in Helsinki had happened under conditions of deterrence.
Of what?
Deterrence.
So there was nuclear weapons on both sides.
Good.
Thank you.
Yes. Yes, madam.
Sadia Taslim from Qaeda Azam University, Islamabad, and my question is addressed to Mr. Gold. So you listed a number of asymmetric threats faced by Israel. I would appreciate if you could educate us on the relevance of nuclear weapons vis-a-vis militant threats, or to be precise, how would nuclear weapons help you either deter or respond to such threats? And very quickly, you talked about states threatening Israel, suggesting that we'll wipe off Israel from the world map. What exactly is the nature of capability that those states have if we keep the rhetoric aside? Thank you.
So we have a series of questions for Ambassador Gold, changing Israeli positions. What's the position going to be going forward, I guess, is really the question. What cost is there in not attending sessions such as Helsinki was the second question. The example of the South Asia, the collapse of the South Asia weapons-free zone, and then the question, doesn't Israel have to decide soon what approach it wants to take? Is this deterrence or what? And then finally, are nuclear weapons relevant to the terrorist threat against Israel? I'm going to leave you to last because a lot of the questions are for you. Dr. Chubin and then Ambassador.
I don't have any comment on any of those questions.
All right. Fair enough. Ambassador.
I just want to say a few things about reference to the ruling party in Egypt and so on, and the decision for the conference being taken in 2010, where circumstances and the security paradigm were different from what it is now. We are speaking of a regime or a government in Egypt that has succeeded democratically and honored its peace commitments with Israel, brokered a very important ceasefire with Hamas and so on and so forth. So we really have to be positive when we think about, and I hate to see these matters put as an alibi in order to stop what we are all trying to reach for and achieve. Yes, our part of the world is different. Egypt particularly is different. There are many challenges, but you have a more public active role. You have a youth that is very vibrant in the case of my country. 30 or 35% are under the age of 20. You have accountability that is being instilled and followed every day. And you have, of course, civil empowerment that is also very important. But if you take the case of South Africa, South Africa under apartheid had developed 6 nuclear weapon heads and had conducted 2 tests, 77 and 79, one of them in the Kalahari Desert, and so on. And when the decision came that a fundamental change was going to happen in the case of South Africa from apartheid to a majority black rule, South Africa chose to rescind the nuclear path, to dismantle the 6 nuclear weapons, and to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty as a non-nuclear weapon state.
Ambassador Gold, final comment.
Well, just on the South African case, I mean, South Africa is completely irrelevant for our discussion here. It's mostly an internal issue and not one where the South Africa was threatened with destruction by Mozambique or Namibia or whatever. I mean, it's a whole different story, so it's hard to bring in terms of analogies here. You know, there has been arms control in the Middle East. There are signatories to the NPT. And what we keep finding out, if we look at Iran, Syria, Iraq, is that there are massive violations of these international agreements with direct security implications for the state of Israel. We didn't find out about Natanz in Iraq until 2002 when the Iranian opposition revealed it. We didn't know about the facility at Fordo until it was suddenly revealed in 2009. The Syrian reactor, which is a North Korean reactor, suddenly came to world attention, and somehow it also vanished up in smoke, but nonetheless, it was a massive violation of the NPT. And we're facing a region where the intentions that are being articulated against my country and the capabilities being developed, you put those together and you have an existential threat. And therefore, if you're going down this route of a nuclear weapons-free zone, you better be certain that this can deliver security and not just give a cover for clandestine nuclear and other weapons of mass destruction initiatives in the region. I think that's something that Israel will take into account, the people of Israel will take into account when the issue arises. But I want to go back to the issue of credibility. When you're a diplomat, it's one thing to have these meetings in different places in the world, and there's this whole professional language of preparatory meetings and PrepCon 1 and PrepCon 2 and et cetera, et cetera. But you have to present your people with how are you as a diplomat making your country more secure? And I think that's the challenge that we face as diplomats. We can't come up with proposals that look like they're completely divorced from reality. And unfortunately, that's what's happened. Now, this particular session is called Nuclear Weapons Free Zone in light of the Arab Spring. So one has to identify the conditions of the Arab Spring that make this discussion somehow changed, because after all, the whole idea of having this conference started, as I said before, in 2010, before events got started in Tunisia and then spread elsewhere. And I think as we go forward, we shouldn't forget the inspiration to have a dialogue on regional security, to build mechanisms for regional security. But in light of the gravity of the capabilities being developed and the intentions being articulated, we have to take positions that provide for the security of our countries. I just want to say one thing about Iran that people don't understand. This is not some theoretical enrichment program. The IAEA has reported the Iranians are trying to take their Shahab 3 missiles, which have 1,300-kilometer range, can strike Israel, remove the conventional warhead, and put in a nuclear warhead in the future. That's in the IAEA reports. It's not theoretical. When the Shahab 3 is paraded in Tehran in military parades, they actually put on the side of the missile carrier, Israel must be wiped off the map. Nobody has questioned the translation skills of the Pazderan. They write it in English. So that is the world we're dealing with, as unfortunate as it might be. But again, our proposals have to reflect reality and not an unrealistic view of our region.
So on that note, I want to thank the panelists for what I found a quite substantive and useful discussion, and thank all of you for being with us.